Think Health Science is made possible by UT Medicine San Antonio.
Good evening and welcome to a discussion tonight that we think is going to offer some encouragement to the many families, many of you out there, who know what it's like to have a parent or a loved one or a family member with Alzheimer's or dementia. As you know, there's no cure for Alzheimer's, but we believe there is some promising research that's underway, and some of it's taking place right here at the UT Health Science Center's Barshop Institute. And it's that research that we're going to be talking about tonight. I'm Texas Public Radio's news director, Shelley Koffler. I'd like to welcome all of you here. TPR is proud to present tonight's first Think Health Science program, A Leap Toward a Treatment for Alzheimer's Disease. And in a few moments, you're going to be hearing from one of the leading researchers about the progress that's being made by her team exploring Alzheimer's treatments. And we're going to reserve some time at the end of the presentation for questions from Dr. Galvin and also some other experts who are here. But first, I'd like you to welcome me, or no, I wouldn't like you to welcome me. I'd like you to join me in welcoming Dr. William Henrich, who has served as the president of the Health Science Center since 2009.
Thank you very much, Shelley, and a warm welcome to all of you. It's sincerely a privilege to have all of you here on the campus tonight and to collaborate with Texas Public Radio in sponsoring this new Think Health Science Center series. We're delighted to see so many in attendance and look forward to the program that will be presented tonight. You know, it's easy for me to say this, but it's harder to accomplish what the purpose of research is, and that is so that tomorrow dawns brighter than today. And the only way that that can happen is through our steadfast investment in science. What will ultimately unlock the mystery of Alzheimer's disease are clinical trials and basic science devoted to the elucidation of the basic mechanisms which first cause and then promote and continue this disorder. And that takes, first of all, expertise, content expertise, to be devoted to this purpose, but it also takes resources. It takes resources in building a scientific community that is funded adequately to investigate these problems. Now, the payoff for this is that ultimately this disease will join the pantheon of diseases which have ultimately been helped or cured. But we're on a steep hill here. This isn't an easy task. It takes the devotion of all of us and all of our citizens, really, to understand the purpose and the sincerity of purpose that we have in doing this. Alzheimer's disease is particularly vexing. It's estimated that just in a few years, 7.1 million people are expected to have this disorder, a 40% increase from today, by the end of just a few years from now. In addition, in Texas, these numbers are expected to double because we're a retirement destination, because so many people in our country want to move to warm weather climates for their retirement. So we have a high density of older individuals who seek out Texas and San Antonio in particular as retirement destinations. So in Texas, we will face all of the challenges presented by this disorder as a public health challenge that the whole country is going to face. All of you are aware of the aging of the population and therefore the public health difficulties that await us. In just 2 weeks, we're having a gala, an annual gala that we hold at the Health Science Center, in which we're going to devote the proceeds of the gala to a project that I have a keen interest in, which is the development of an Alzheimer's Institute at the Health Science Center. Now, this wouldn't just be a basic science institute. It's a clinical, comprehensive clinical institute that we have in mind, and I'll tell you why. Because today, in the care of individuals who are suspected of having Alzheimer's disease, it's difficult to find in San Antonio, it's difficult to find anywhere a comprehensive place where you can go and get accurate diagnosis, where you can have availability of clinical trials, and where you can be followed longitudinally to see how you do. This is a need for our community of San Antonio, but across our state. This came home to me when one of our closest friends of our Health Science Center came to see me 18 months ago in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease and asked me where he could go. And I found a place in Los Angeles. I found a place in Rochester, Minnesota. I found a place in San Francisco. I found a place in Boston. But in Texas and in San Antonio, there were no comprehensive places that put all of these ingredients together in one spot. So I am excited, and we are excited, about creating this effort. We'll do it in partnership with many collaborators in town. First of all of the other research organs in town, our partners in universities such as UTSA and Southwest Research Institute, Texas Biomedical, but also with the Alzheimer's Association and with other gifted and talented individuals in our community who can help with the lifting of such a project. So I'm very excited about this, and stay tuned for more information about that. So it's a pleasure to have you here. It's a pleasure to be tackling with this subject matter tonight a difficult problem that is on the minds of all of us. It's fair to say that all of us are touched in some personal way by the specter of this illness. And we need to fight back, and we need to defeat it. So hopefully tonight's discussion will enlighten us as to what's possible and where the field is going. I want to thank Texas Public Radio again for the opportunity to host you on campus, and I'll turn the program back over to Shelley. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Henrich, and thank you, UT Health Science Center, for offering us very kindly this beautiful auditorium where we can have our presentation tonight. Now I'd like to introduce Dr. Veronica Galvan, who's going to tell us about some of the really fascinating and promising research for treating Alzheimer's. Dr. Galvan grew up in Buenos Aires, Argentina, where she earned her molecular biology degree at the Center for Advanced Studies in Exact Sciences. She then earned her doctoral degree at the University of Chicago. And as I was saying to her before, I grew up in the Midwest, and only really, really smart people get into the University of Chicago. After that, she joined the Barshop Institute for Longevity and Aging Studies, and she did that in 2009, and she's been working on her research here ever since. And now, here's part of what's going to be exciting tonight. She's going to be telling us about what her laboratory researchers have discovered in a drug that delays aging, reverses Alzheimer-like memory loss, and has other promising effects in the brains of mice. So, what does that mean for us humans? Well, in just a few minutes, we're going to find out. And I'm very pleased now to welcome Dr. Galvan to tell us more about what she's doing.
Thank you. Thank you, Shelley. Thank you, Dr. Henrich. Thanks so much. I am really delighted. It is my pleasure to be here tonight and to start this exciting series. So what we're going to do today is discuss some of the research that we are carrying out. This is an effort that is led, what I'm going to show you is mostly work from my lab. I'm going to also put it in context of the knowledge in the field, and I'm also going to show you some of the clinical, the beginnings of clinical research on this topic. So I believe that the research that we're doing and what I'm going to show you today is really pushing the boundaries, and it's really, really at the edge of what we can do and how we're progressing into understanding Alzheimer's disease and possibly other diseases of aging. So the research is really going into a new area that has not been investigated before, not because we did not have an interest in it, but because we didn't really have strong tools to address the questions. So we're really, really pushing a boundary and going into uncharted territory that's going to give us a lot of knowledge, and knowledge will translate into the ability to find treatment for diseases and cure for diseases. So we're going to talk about Alzheimer's disease today. And as you probably all know, Alzheimer's disease is a relatively pure cognitive impairment, and what this means is that it initially manifests as a deficit in memory, and in particular in short-term memory or in the making of new memories, and may leave old memories intact. There's also initial problems with decision-making and task assigning and prioritization. There's subtle but distinguishable cognitive impairments. However, as the disease progresses and it goes into a steady progression, other domains of cognitive function and other domains of brain function are also impaired. And you can see here how these are areas of the brain, and how as the disease progresses, some histological hallmarks, so essentially some lesions that we can actually see in the brain that are called amyloid beta plaques and tau tangles, progress together with further functional decline. Eventually, the disease will lead to overt dementia and to a loss of personality, essentially disintegration of personality, and loss of many, many functions that eventually will lead to a decline in vital functions, and unfortunately it will be a fatal outcome. So this is a fatal disease. From what we know, so essentially from all the research that has been carried out so far, we have identified, the field has identified these two proteins. These are components of our brain cells, and that are normal. Essentially, there's nothing wrong with them. We all have them. Eventually, they become modified or they become overabundant and they become pathological. And it's very well understood that they play a role into the pathogenesis of the disease. We don't really have time tonight to go into more detail, but that should suffice. So there's ongoing clinical trials addressing these two potential and proven sources of toxicity in Alzheimer's disease, clinical trials on inflammation, insulin resistance, and there's an interesting clinical trial that is trying to address prevention and test the possibility of prevention in families that are a small, very, very small proportion of all the cases of Alzheimer's disease in which the disease is inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion. So half of the family will develop the disease for sure. So what about these diseases of aging that we're talking about, including Alzheimer's disease? So even though Alzheimer's disease is a neurological disease of aging, essentially it requires a certain degree of aging. Basically, there will not be disease before the fourth decade, and that's a long, long time for something that is not functional, not to manifest itself. And this is even true for inherited familial forms of the disease. So there is a very, very strong component of aging, and you will see in a moment how that works out. But as you know, if we represent cognitive aging as this trajectory that each individual is going to transit along their lives, there are many different outcomes that are possible. So there are many, many people who are able to age cognitively intact and basically do not suffer from any significant decline as they age. However, there's the potential, and we really don't know exactly how this happens, and we're trying to find out, as you will see. But at some point, some people will essentially encounter a combination of potentially environmental and genetic factors that will modify this trajectory and lead them to very specific, according to this, to specific susceptibilities and life events may result in Alzheimer's or in Parkinson's disease, vascular dementia, and other age-associated neurological diseases. So these are all diseases of aging. So, and they all have this big core root that is increasing age. So how important is aging? Do we really, is this something that really contributes a lot to disease? So I will show you some data about that. So these are some risk factors for Alzheimer's disease. And they're not all of the risk factors that we know about, but you can see here the relative impact and how they contribute to risk. Now, if in this same graph we would plot, and we're going to do that in a moment, if we plot the risk that is contributed by aging, what you will see is that we have changed even this. We had to change the scale here by several orders of magnitude. And what you can see is that if we put aging in the picture, it completely dwarfs the risk that is contributed by any other factor, by a large amount. So aging contributes more than 90% and is close to 95% of the risk for Alzheimer's disease and other age-associated dementias. If we could intervene and we could somehow slow down or have an impact in the process of aging itself, we would have a really large impact on the prevalence of Alzheimer's disease, just because this contributes so much of the risk. But you will be probably are thinking, as I'm telling you this, well, that is impossible. That's an impossibility. We cannot change the rate of aging. Aging is something immutable. Aging is something that is like a law of physics, something that we can observe, but we can't really change. Well, it turns out that is not true. So we know for a long time, almost a century now, that caloric restriction, essentially restricting the amount of food and in terms of restricting the amount of calories that animals ingest, this experiment has not yet been done, or we don't have really good data for humans. But in many, many species, if we restrict the amount of calories and we do caloric restriction, aging is delayed and animals live much longer. And about 15 to 20 years ago, the first indications and the first data came from really experiments in really humble organisms such as the fly, unicellular organisms such as yeast, and even worms. Data and experiments were done to demonstrate, and this was a great discovery, that actually the rate of aging is regulated by genes. And what that means is that we can actually address and identify the culprits, the guilty parties, those functions in our cells with names that we can actually identify, and then that gives us the power to develop drugs or to develop devices or approaches to treat them. So this was something that obviously did not go unnoticed to the National Institutes of Health, and in particular the National Institutes on Aging. And what the National Institutes on Aging did is to create a testing program. And the idea was so the idea was exactly what I just told you. If we identify these culprits and we can identify these genes, we can develop drugs. We can't really genetically modify people, we can't do that, but we have been very, very successful at using drugs. So an effort was created, and there's three large centers. One is here in our institution at the Barshop Institute within the Health Science Center. The other one is in the University of Michigan, and the third one is in the Jackson Laboratory, which is a large, large repository in Maine. So these three centers run these experiments in coordination and at the same time in large, large numbers of animals to find drugs that delay the process of aging. And the idea here is that if we do really slow down or have a small impact on the rate of aging, we will have an incredible tool to address Alzheimer's disease and many other diseases potentially. So the first breakthrough came in 2009 with the discovery of the first drug that potently extended lifespan, extended the time of life, and extended not only that, but also the health span of mice in these three centers. And this was essentially a demonstration that aging can be slowed down in a species that is really close to us, although we're very different. Mice and humans shared a lot of biology. We're both members of the mammalian family. And this was the first time ever that aging was slowed down in mice and using a drug. So this was reported in the most prominent journal that reports the really, really the breakthroughs and the really, really important discoveries in all realms of science, from the physical sciences and mathematics through biology. So this was such a big deal, really, that it was chosen as one of the breakthroughs of the year by another journal, very prestigious, the Science magazine. And it was chosen as one of the very transformative discoveries in 2009. So it really made a big splash, and it was reported in many, many news venues. And what this gave us, essentially at that time, I was joining the Health Science Center, and I found myself in a situation where I could ask questions that had never been asked before. So until this discovery was made available, we have been studying. If you want to, if you can picture Alzheimer's disease as this big iceberg, we have been studying, in a sense, a little bit the tip of the iceberg. Not because people were blind to the existence of the submerged part of the iceberg, but because we only had tools to address these questions for sure. We could study aging, and lots of studies on brain aging have been performed. Lots of very useful and important data, but we could not really draw a direct connection because we had no way of linking aging, of modifying aging, and seeing what is it that we're actually doing to modify the process of a disease. So there were many, many correlative. That means that we associate one thing with the other, but we can never be sure whether those things are really associated. And to give you an example, when we age, there's many events. We get wrinkles, we get gray hair, we get heart disease, and we get kidney disease. And you can intuitively guess which ones are going to increase your mortality. However, for brain aging, we could not really say what is it that is a wrinkle in brain aging. What is it about brain aging that is really not so important, that is not contributing to this vulnerability of brains to neurological diseases of aging, and distinguish those from the really fundamental and mechanistic causes that are driving the diseases of aging in the brain. So what we, my lab set out to do is to pursue two goals. So on one hand, we wanted to answer the question that I just posed to you. What is it about slowing down brain aging that makes brains resistant, that is going to be critical for maintaining health of this brain? And that is the mechanistic part. On the other hand, we also wanted to test this notion that we may have at hand with the discovery of rapamycin, of this drug that delays organismal aging. Test the idea that we could use this as a tool to treat diseases of aging, and because we're interested in the brain, we focused on Alzheimer's disease. So one is an immediate application to potentially clinical use, and the other one is just trying to find out how this works. So the first question about whether this would be applicable to Alzheimer's disease had to be asked in a model system that we use, which are mice that model the disease and have been engineered to have Alzheimer's disease. And the way that this has been done is to create animals that belong to a family. It is really very similar to a family where Alzheimer's disease is genetically inherited. So we have animals that are siblings. Half of them are going to develop the disease. Half of them are not going to develop the disease. And because we know what we have done, we know exactly when they're going to get the disease, and we can do all sorts of treatments and manipulations. So what we did is take members of these families, large numbers of them, and either treat them with control or treat them with rapamycin, with the drug that slowed down aging. And what we found is that while Alzheimer's mice show very pronounced decreases, if this is learning and memory, these animals have severe deficits in their ability to remember and learn new things. However, the brothers and sisters that have been treated with rapamycin show completely indistinguishable memory and learning from animals that are their siblings and are not affected by the disease. And we did this at a time when these animals had already cognitive impairments. So essentially, we were mimicking a situation of a presumptive diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease in a human. And even though these animals already had cognitive impairment, we were able to restore their ability to remember to non-affected sibling levels. So we wanted to know how this worked. And we were very fortunate to establish a collaboration with people at our Research Imaging Institute who could do MRIs, in special Dr. Eileen Ling. And among many, many experiments that we did, we measured the ability of brains to be perfused. We measured how blood flows in the brain. And this is really important, and you will see in a moment why. But in a normal animal, what you see here are real MRI images. So in a normal animal, what you have, the white signal here is blood. And so you have this level of perfusion. You can see whenever you see white is blood that is going through this brain. And as you can see here, you can in this image, there's a substantial decrease in blood flow, basal blood flow in Alzheimer's disease mice that is completely restored to normal-like levels in animals that have been treated with rapamycin. And if I show you quantitative, these are numbers. So essentially we collect that those data from many, many animals and we crunch it all together. And as you can see here, a profound deficit in Alzheimer's disease mice is completely restored to normal levels by rapamycin treatment. And so we were excited about this discovery, and this is because blood flow is very important. So why is it important? Well, as you probably understand, we need the blood to bring in nutrients, to bring in oxygen, to keep the tissue alive. At the same time, what we need the blood in the waist and in the brain and in the rest of the body, but very particularly for the brain, we need the blood to remove metabolic waste, and that includes that snippet of a protein, that protein that I mentioned initially, that is called amyloid beta. So the vasculature has a critical role in actually taking all that toxic elements out of the brain continuously. It's continuously doing that. So you can see how important it is and how this would lead essentially to a decrease in the amount of this toxic peptide. So these are also real images from brains. These are some aggregates and some of these lesions that I mentioned a few moments ago, where you can see the green dots are lesions in the brain that are formed by this amyloid beta, and how in animals that have been treated with rapamycin, these are substantially reduced. Furthermore, a couple of days ago, we got data that from a collaborator and a studies that we're doing in the lab that I'm very excited about, where we can measure directly the amount of this toxic molecule in the brain while animals are performing. So this is completely non-invasive. Well, it's invasive, but there's no suffering involved. But we can directly measure. And so we did that. I am sorry that doesn't show. I will have to tell you. So basically we found that indeed the peptide is cleared out of the brain, and we find this increased flow out of the brain. So there's an increase in the clearance and in the cleaning up of the brain in the animals that have been treated with rapamycin. So At this point, we asked ourselves, if we have done this, so we have been able to essentially treat the disease in a mouse with rapamycin and restore cognitive function, but we don't know how long. So we did this, and we tested the function shortly after or months after the treatment. So how long can this happen? So would this be something that is a temporary improvement? Would this be something that we can actually sustain? Is it something that will the disease will override all of this beneficial effects? We didn't know. So the people in my lab, actually, this experiment, and I didn't know that they were running it, and I was really, really surprised, and I was really excited when I saw this data. So what you're seeing here are data from animals that have reached the end of lifespan. And what I'm going to show you is that, this data that you see here are animals that are the equivalent of 95 to 100-year-old humans. And so it cannot be, essentially you cannot find disease that is more advanced than that. And that is manifested here in these animals. This is another test of memory, and they have profound reductions in their ability to remember. However, the animals that were treated with rapamycin have memory that is completely comparable to that of unaffected siblings. And this was really a stunning discovery for us. So we were really excited to see this. Now, at this point, we thought, okay, we have... basically, we can stop the progression of the disease in animals by using this drug that delays aging, that delays the process of aging. So we know that that is true at the organismal level. But then if we go back to our original assumptions and we say if we're modifying the process of aging, then it would be expected that we should be able to also modify the progression of disease for other disease models, such as atherosclerosis, for instance. And we should be able also to modify the process of cognitive aging per se in a species that suffers from cognitive aging in all its individuals, and I'll show you the data for that. So we should be able to delay cognitive aging, which is memory losses associated with pure aging, without any disease process. And because we could study, we had a chance to study atherosclerosis that is also age-dependent, cognitive dysfunction associated with it, we also did that experiment. And what we found is that just like we had seen for Alzheimer's, treatment with rapamycin was sufficient to restore cognitive function in animals suffering from vascular dementia, and this was associated with a complete restoration of vascular density, and I'm not going to show you the data, but this density here of vessels in the brain is also restoring the perfusion of the brain, it's restoring blood flow. So we see exactly the same that we had seen for the Alzheimer's disease mice. In addition, we did an experiment with really, really old rats. So we had rats that were 36 months of age, and that's as old as you can, find a rat to be. And so we worked with these animals. We also were fortunate to have access to them through a collaboration. And what we found in those animals is that just as we had seen for Alzheimer's and for a model of vascular dementia, and these are non-diseased animals. These are not modeling any disease. These are just very, very old rats. What you can see here, and this is just a nicer or fancier image for an MRI, the same that I showed you, the same type of assay, the same type of technology that I showed you earlier. What you can see here is that these red and yellow areas, color-coded here, represent high levels of blood flow. Those are almost completely lost in an old individual as compared to a young one. But they're completely restored, essentially, to not significantly different levels in animals of exactly the same age as this group, but that have been treated with rapamycin. And furthermore, because rats are more amenable to certain experiments, we were able to do something that's called functional MRI. And you may have heard about this technique. You surely have heard in the news about the discovery of the region of the brain that is responsible for happiness or is responsible for grouchiness or anything. I mean, this is something that sometimes is shown in the media, where you see areas of the brain that are lighting up with specific brain activity. So what this represents is the ability of the brain cells, the brain networks, to activate and work. And at the same time, they are being fed by the vasculature. And that's actually what you see in the fMRI. So you can see both the cells activating. That means that they're active and they're working and they're functioning fine. And it means that also the vasculature is there to provide oxygen, to provide nutrients. The two things together will give you the signal in the MRI. And this is what we did with the rats, and they were somatosensory. There was some sensory stimulation. They were touched, and that lit up the region of the brain that senses that and the response to that. And in old animals, as you can see, what is the typical response that you can see in a young animal in this region of the brain, this response is severely blunted, and that is expected. These animals develop this severe cognitive impairments and brain functional impairments with age. However, in animals that were treated with rapamycin, the response was completely restored to levels that are not significantly different from those of young animals. So we believe, think that we have so far validated our hypothesis, and that we are actually, because of all this, the only thing that is in common, or one of the most interesting things that is in common between all these models that we have tested, and we see the same mechanistic associations, and we have drawn some causal relationships with the vasculature. In all of these models, a very, very strong commonality is the fact of aging. So we think that our hypothesis is holding true, and that we may be actually delaying the process of brain aging, and thus having an impact on all these diverse deficiencies and diseases associated with aging as they are modeled in rodents. So one of the implications of this research, and something that we're pursuing, and that is something that is moving into the next step. So what I've shown you is only basic, or it's just the basic research done in experimental situations and with model animals in the laboratory. Now, what our data justifies thinking about going into the clinic and starting clinical trials. You will hear, I will show you a little bit of that. And there's Dr. Kellogg here who can actually expand on what I'm going to show you. But the way that we're thinking about using this knowledge that we have generated is that rapamycin, other drugs that are very similar, that are derivatives of rapamycin, that are called rapalogs, and other inhibitors similar to these drugs that are in development, including here at the Health Science Center, can be used or might be very useful to address changes associated with aging, and may have a very potent effect on the progression of Alzheimer's disease and potentially other diseases, neurological diseases of aging. But we envision this probably, we think that probably this is going to end up being a situation, and this is a disease that is a complex disease, we know that by now, and that will require most likely the use of combined therapies, more than one drug. And so we can envision a situation where other drugs that are being developed and that we recently in July have heard about, so there's encouraging news, in that one of them may be disease-modifying, so essentially may really be acting at the root of the causes of the disease. So there's really encouraging news in that area and in that area of research in particular. And these drugs act on the accumulation of this protein that I was telling you about that is known to be toxic to the brain. So basically, we can envision this combination and other therapies and other ways of treating Alzheimer's disease, particularly because some of these drugs, unfortunately, have been shown to have undesirable consequences in that they have vascular effects that are undesirable and that can lead to actual vascular discompensation and damage. So it could be, it's one of the most interesting ideas that we could actually be preventing aging of the brain and having one of the mechanisms centered at the vasculature, making the vasculature healthy and combining this with other therapies. So that's one possibility. And to end my talk today, I would like to briefly mention a clinical trial. So we're translating this into the clinic at the institution. So we're working with clinicians, in particular with Dr. Kellogg at the VA. So this is a study that Dr. Kellogg has been directing, and where the subjects are veterans that have volunteered to participate. And it's essentially a safety study. So the goal is to establish safety. That means to figure out whether we can actually use this drug with older patients and whether it would be safe to do so. And I understand from Dr. Kellogg that there are no untoward effects and that the drug is well tolerated in the treatment and in the plan and the doses that he has been administering. And these patients have been doing some studies. So there have been some studies that have been done on this small number of patients. But those have yielded some really encouraging data. What I'm showing you here is just a summary for a few data points, essentially. So there's just a few patients, but there have been in clear increases in cognitive ability, some improvements in motivation, and some improvements in mobility. So we're really excited about this. And to end my talk, I have made it a point to remind people whenever I have a chance to talk to community members. I've made a point to remind people about the importance of research. So we get our knowledge from research. Everything that we have in the biomedical sciences has been painstakingly acquired through hard work, long years of research, and then we have been able to apply this knowledge because knowledge is power, and it's the power in the biomedical field to treat and to cure, and we get this knowledge from research. So I just wanted to make that comment. And another comment I would like to make is that what you just heard is only one of the many projects in a thriving research program that is run here at the Health Science Center. There are many, many researchers doing extraordinary and very exciting research, and you will hear from other researchers in further talks in this series. So I would like to make that point and stress the goal of all this activity, and that is to advance one of the missions of the institution in making lives better. So thank you very much for your attention, and I will take questions if there are any. Thank you.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
And we're going to continue our discussion now with Dr. Galvan and two other experts, some of them her colleagues who are here with us tonight. And so if the three of you don't mind taking seats up front, we have one microphone we'll pass among you. Along with Dr. Galvan is Dr. Diane Solomon, a geriatric neurologist who has served in several leadership positions here at the Health Science Center since 1997. She specializes in memory disorders, providing diagnoses, treatment, and counseling for dementia patients and their families. And then on the end, Dr. Dean Kellogg, who you heard Dr. Galvan talk about. He holds positions at the Health Science Center and at the Audie L. Murphy Memorial VA Hospital. That's a mouthful. He's currently studying how rapamycin and other pharmacological agents alter the aging process in humans. So in a sense, he's taking some of the research that Dr. Galvan and her team have come up with, and he's applying them to people, to human beings. And so I know we have people out in the audience with microphones. If you have a question, raise your hand.
And while you're formulating your questions, let me just ask Dr. Kellogg, could you take just a few minutes and tell us how you've translated this some of this information to clinical trials and who you've been helping and how you've selected the people who you've been working with?
Well, have I got this working? Yes, I think so.
Mm-hmm.
So my interest really comes from the side of the geriatrician who has to deal with older patients. I see veterans at the VA. The average age of my patients is probably in their late 80s, so they're in the oldest old. And when the first studies came out with rapamycin, I had never thought I would see a pharmacological agent that would alter aging. Yeah, sure, food restriction delays aging, but how many patients can you tell eat less, exercise more, and then they do it? One, two out of thousands? So here was a pill you could give. And one of the delights of this pill was it had already been FDA approved for use in humans. So the bureaucracy battle had already been won. It was used, it's approved for use in transplant biology as an immunosuppressant, which is good and bad. It's good because it's approved. It's bad because a lot of the clinicians in the community and I just view this as an immunosuppressant.
You're going to turn those old people into petri dishes. They're all going to rot. You can't use that.
But, well, we decided we'd try. So I took some of the patients that I took care of at the Audie Murphy. They were all World War II veterans except for one. He was Korean War. So they were all in their 80s, mostly in their late 80s, early 90s. We randomized them to two groups and gave them 1 milligram of rapamycin once a day or placebo. And we measured their responses to, in terms of immunological function, how much antibody they formed to a hepatitis B vaccination. We measured their physical performance. We measured grip strength and walking speed. And we'd become aware of some of Dr. Galvin's work on cognition in the Alzheimer's mice. And so we got some additional funding through the Baptist Foundation and added some cognitive testing to the group. They were treated for 4 months, and we tested them at the beginning and the end, and we monitored them for any problems that would occur with the drug or the placebo. And they really didn't have any trouble. One veteran thought he got a little bit loose stool on the drug. The rest couldn't tell they were on it. They didn't know if they were on the placebo or the rapamycin. So in terms of safety, it turned out to be a very safe drug. And we only had a total of 8 thus far. And what have we found? Well, Dr. Galvin showed you the changes in the cognitive tests. They did seem to improve in the rapamycin-treated veterans. One of the more profound changes was in walking speed. And we found no change in grip strength. But there was one gentleman, actually it was the gentleman with the hat, it took him 17.8 seconds to walk 40 feet when we started. After 4 months of taking the drug, he went 40 feet in 7.8 seconds. He was a fast fellow. Once the study was over, we stopped the drug, and I kept seeing the patients. The one veteran who had particularly improved in terms of cognition, his family came to me after the trial and said, can we get him back on that drug? Was he on the real one or was he on the placebo? Well, he was on the real stuff. He really seemed better when he was on that. Can we get that for him? And they wrote a nice long email about how much better he had seemed to do while on the pill. Now, that's all anecdotal, but it certainly was promising. We're right now trying to We're now doing all the approvals necessary to follow up with CNS imaging and carrying this study further. So that's pretty much what we've done with the veterans, and
okay,
it's been a lot of fun.
Pretty promising, I would say. I know I saw some hands up over here. We'll start with this gentleman, and then we'll come to this side and take a question from someone over here.
My question is, if I understand to Dr.
Galvan,
you
may need to speak up just a little.
Dr. Galvan, did I understand you correctly that blood flow through the brain might be something that would be beneficial to people as well?
Yes, definitely. So essentially that really mimics, that is one of the aspects of disease. There is deficiencies in blood flow and in vascular function are really early. They're an early injury, let's say, or an early manifestation of disease in Alzheimer's disease patients. So even at the mild cognitive impairment stage when we there's not even a presumptive diagnosis, it's present. And so this is something that the models or the animals mimic really well, and we believe that this would be probably, you know, very, very important in terms of application to humans, and that's why Dr. Keller was making, we really would like to know whether we're actually getting that also in humans, and thus we're planning these experiments where, well, not experiments, but these studies where human patients, human subjects will be, blood flow will be measured, and we will know whether we're doing that also in humans as well.
Okay. Do we have another question from this gentleman?
I just had a simple question about the studies done on the mice. How exactly would you measure their cognitive abilities, per se?
Oh, we have many tricks, and so there's a whole. So this is a field in itself in research, and there are very, very standardized tools, very precisely defined and standardized, where we can just follow the. So we go. With what mice or rats like to do, so things, or we exploit their aversions, the things that they don't like and things that they will run away from. And there are like games that are designed to actually test whether they remember or not. And it's something like, for instance, one of them that is very powerful and that we use a lot has to do with finding, so the mice and rats don't like to, they can swim, they're great swimmers, but water means to them that their burrows are being flooded and that they are in mortal, you know, peril. So essentially, water is aversive. It's, we have to get out of here, is the message of water, even treading water. So we use a pool full of water, and it's opacified with paint, so you can't really see inside, you know, below the water. And somewhere there is a platform where they can step on, and they can just sit there and be treading a very small amount of water. And so we just, because they have a natural incentive to get out, they look for a way out. And when they find the platform, they, like we all do, we make a map. All of you are going to be able to get out of this room without even thinking about it because you actually made a map. Your brain has been working a lot without you knowing, making a map of where, you know, how to get back to your car or, you know, whatever way you got here. So for the mice, it's exactly the same. So if they can acquire that, then we can test how strongly they remember where that platform was. And they just... We take many days, and they just learn. It's a game. They say, okay, that's what they want us to do. And eventually we're able to test whether they remember it. And so that's just one. And we have many others, and essentially they're just, you know, games, basically, that the mice can play. Like you would take, you know, you would teach a trick to your dog as something very, very similar.
Okay, great. Another question?
Hi, I'm Glenn Hover. I just retired from the Air Force after 30 years, and I was out at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base where we have our School of Aerospace Medicine, and I'm now the Veterans Liaison for VITAS. And we were doing some unique work with the University of Cincinnati for our air medical evacuation teams, and I just wanted to point it out if you weren't aware of it. They were doing traumatic brain injury on mice, inducing both premature aging and then looking at also the hypoxia insult to the brain as they travel in transit for air medical evacuation. So I'm seeing nods. That's good. That was fascinating to me to see that because you see, you know, reduced executive decision making, and we're seeing a lot of early onset symptoms in our traumatic brain injury guys. And so I didn't know if you were addressing that in any future research, and obviously it sounds like you're in collaboration there. Thanks.
Yes, and like... Basically, there's the limitation of time and resources, but this is something that we're really, really interested in, considering our community environment and how, you know, how strong our association with the VA. So we have a very strong component of research that is at the GREC at the VA, and we are very, very interested in that. We have researchers here, Dr. Jim Lacklider in particular, who is a good collaborator, and that we have been planning studies where we would test exactly the questions that you're bringing up and how repetitive traumatic brain injury or single events, how can we model that? We have protocols, we have a plan, and now we're really waiting for the opportunity, both in having, you know, hands to researchers to do that, and as well the resources. But we are planning a DOD application, and we have that in mind very, very prominently. Yeah.
Okay. While we get ready to take another question, I thought I might ask Dr. Diane Solomon a question. You deal in a treatment setting, and you counsel families. Most patients can't get into a clinical trial. Are there other things you can do in a clinical setting that helps people at least maintain their status quo where they are?
Yes. At least we implement what the current state of knowledge is. And so there is overlap in what's been presented today. We do know that exercise is very beneficial to people who already are diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, but also as a preventive strategy. There's good evidence for that. And there is the belief that the benefit of exercise is very global, but involves blood flow, for one thing, involves decreased inflammation, involves improved mood. Those of you who have family members who suffer from this disease, oftentimes there's some anxiety and agitation involved, and exercise can be beneficial. And so that's one of the things that I really do emphasize, even though Dr. Kellogg's right, it's hard to change your habits and begin exercise if you're not an exerciser, but I really work with families and my patients to encourage that because I think it makes a really big difference. There's information about diet that I think can be helpful. You guys that follow this are probably very well aware of the Mediterranean diet and the DASH diet, and now we have the MIND diet. I think they're all good. I think that to eat a lot of fresh produce and lean meats as opposed to red meats, these are all healthy strategies that can make a small but important difference. I think it's important to empower patients and their families that there are some things to do to help this devastating disease. And then, of course, we do have some medications. We don't have the home run medications that we want. We don't, at this point, have available clinically, at least, medications that change the underlying disease process. But our medications do help some of the symptoms and do make a difference. So there's not enough that we can do, but there are some things that we can do.
Okay, thank you. Another question?
Just an observation. They say there's a tsunami of these illnesses headed our way. But some of you are too young to remember when the March of Dimes really was the March of Dimes. And as children, we collected nickels and dimes because we believed that research would solve the problem of polio and people would not be crippled. And my father had polio and was crippled all his life. So My mother, who was a nurse, was very concerned that we not go swimming in the summertime, that we not attract the virus, and we didn't. But very soon after, all those nickels and dimes were sent to, in this case, Washington, D.C., there was a vaccine developed, and very few of us now know of polio, thank the Lord. So, you know, we're part of the solution in this situation, and I'm very grateful for that. And thank you for devoting your lives to these efforts.
So it sounds like you're saying we need to collect some nickels and dimes.
Yes.
I have a feeling the researchers would agree with you. Another question? If we can maybe get inside on the end. There we go.
Am I? Do you hear me?
Yeah.
This is for Dr. Kellogg. I wanted to ask you if you need any more volunteers for your study, because I am a World War II veteran, and I am in my late 80s. So, and I also am a caregiver for an Alzheimer's patient. So,
that's
yes.
A good question about
we love
how
subjects. I noticed your blue hat. What did you do in the military?
I was in all three services, Navy,
oh,
Army, and the Air Force. So the last
wow. Year. Thanks for your service.
31 years and loved it all.
Well, I'll have to get you to come to the VA and I can charge you stories. Yes, well, we are hoping to do additional studies. And for me, it's easiest to get veterans because I see them all every day. The Health Science Center has a new center being set up, the Claude D. Pepper Center of Older American Independence Center, and that is going to help fund research in anti-aging pharmacology. And the studies that we hope to continue with the rapamycin are through that outfit. And we're getting the permissions to keep going at the VA. So call up the geriatrics clinic and ask for me.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm an old person. I'm 83, almost 84. My brain works fine. I mean, I publish a monthly blog on my experiences with growing old and stuff like this. My biggest problem is balance. Have you checked that? I mean, that's involves the brain vestibular system and stuff like that, and it may be too far reach, but have you thought about that at all?
Preventing falls would be great. Falls are bad. And it's we haven't specifically thought of looking at balance, but it actually wouldn't be very difficult to do. We've got force balance platforms that we could use. What's interesting about this drug is it really seems to improve health span. And its effects also vary with age. We did some studies with blood flow in young humans, healthy medical students. And we found that they actually, the drug worsened their endothelial function. Their blood vessels didn't dilate as much once they got the drug. But then we did some older persons, those older than 50. And the drug improved their endothelial function. It is a strange drug, fitting for something that came from the soil of Easter Island with those weird statues that actually go down deep into the ground. Would it improve balance? I don't know. It wouldn't be hard to do. It does improve physical function, especially gait. That's what it did seem to do. Since muscle strength is a significant part of balance, it's a reasonable hypothesis to test. So,
as a matter of fact, so there's been studies at the Barshop Institute with the laboratory of Dr. Randy Strong, and this is a group of animals that are similar to the ones that were originally used to discover that rapamycin, this drug, makes life longer and healthier as well. So one of the tests that that the group of Dr. Strong has carried out in further studies is the ability of animals to stay on a rotating rod. So they are put like on a, there's a game with a log, the log, was it something with, I'm sorry, help me here. So, no, the router rod, yes. But I think that there's a game for humans. I mean, people do that, the loggers, the people, yeah, log rolling, so, okay, that's the word for it. So it's exactly the same, but, you know, made for mice. And the animals have significantly improved performance. And that is a very specific test of balance and of this sensory motor coordination and strength that is required to keep balance. So there's, you know, there's an encouraging result, at least from a rodent model.
Okay. While we pass the microphone to someone else, I was asked to ask a question for someone up here who wanted to know about side effects. I think I heard you say earlier that there are relatively few.
The only side effect we noted in our oldest old veteran, he was 93, and after 2 months, he developed some diarrhea that only affected him at night. Was it the drug? I don't know. It might have been. He had that for a while, and then it went away. Other than that, we had no side effects. One of the challenges with getting studies approved with this drug, even though it's FDA approved, comes from it having been thought of as an immunosuppressant. And so it's given to transplant patients. And transplant patients are generally sick. The amounts, the blood levels we got in the patients were very similar to those achieved in the transplant patients, maybe a little bit lower, but not much. The transplant patients have a lot of they get multiple drugs with multiple potential interactions. So that makes it difficult to decide whether their side effect is from one of the other drugs or from the rapamycin. Classically, rapamycin tends to increase blood sugars. We didn't observe that. It tends to increase the blood lipids. We noticed a slight increase in the triglyceride levels, but it also went up in our placebo group, so there wasn't much of a difference. There are other unusual side effects that are reported. In our observations, where we simply added the rapamycin to whatever other drugs the veteran was taking, we didn't modify their drugs, we just added the rapamycin or the placebo, with the exception of the one gentleman who thought that might have been causing his nocturnal diarrhea, they couldn't tell they were taking it. So okay. It's been a pretty benign drug.
I think we have time for maybe two or three more questions, and then if anybody, I think that some of our panelists will be able to stay around afterwards as well if you want to have one-on-one conversations. And I think someone's here from the Alzheimer's Association. I'm not sure where they are, but they're out. There they are. So if you have additional questions and we don't get to them during this group period, then they'll be here to talk to you as well. And so where's the microphone? There we go.
I would like to ask you about a study that I recently heard of correlating a lack of sleep with Alzheimer's. And they talked about the purpose of sleep also is cleaning out the brain in your deep sleep with, I suppose, also the amyloid beta. And I wondered if you had done any research in correlation with that, or if you're working with that in your studies, or if you've accounted for that in your results.
No, I wish. So essentially, I essentially got the news and was made aware of these results, just like you did. And this is something that has been there's the vascular clearance that is more, it's about 80 to 85%. So it's the bulk of amyloid. There's other ways of clearing this aspect of Alzheimer's disease. It's not the only thing, but the role of sleep, it was something that I was not aware of, and I looked at this, and there is a possibility that we will be that we may be running a very small study where we're going to try to disrupt the there's complications with doing this in animals in that you can disrupt. So when you disrupt circadian rhythm, there's so many things that you're doing to the animal in addition to disrupting sleep. So it's not a straightforward experiment. But this is something that we would that is very, very interesting in how it interacts with the mechanism that you just described. You know, yeah, that's a great idea.
I just want to make a comment. So I am not doing research in that area because I'm not a researcher, but I will concur that comes up clinically quite often and that sleep plays a very important role in dementia. I see patients quite often that have undiagnosed sleep apnea, obstructive sleep apnea, and if we treat their sleep apnea, they improve. And it doesn't necessarily mean that that's the cause of the dementia. They may have Alzheimer's disease, but it can definitely make a difference in their ability to function by improving their sleep. So it's a very important thing to address in our patients. Thank you for bringing that up.
Okay, do we have another question?
Can I ask two questions? One is, what is the incidence of Alzheimer's, or the potential for Alzheimer's in San Antonio? I ask this because I used to live in Austin, and in Austin people rappelled, hiked, canoed, had healthier lifestyles, etc.
Well, as Dr. Hinrich mentioned earlier, we have such a large retirement community here that we have a large incidence of Alzheimer's disease just because we have an elderly population. I don't know the statistics off the top of my head. Do you know through the Alzheimer's Association for San Antonio?
That's okay. She can ask the second question.
Okay. The other question is, I've been reading in some new literature, and it says that Alzheimer's may be considered type 3 diabetes. And also in your slides tonight, you showed one that had insulin resistance. And I understand that insulin, you can have insulin resistance problems and have diabetes, but your fasting blood sugar may be normal. Is that correct?
So that's interesting about type 3 diabetes. I had not heard that terminology. But insulin resistance and diabetes are risk factors for Alzheimer's disease. And there is an area of research that's really pursuing that. So there definitely is a connection, which goes back to the dietary interventions, that healthy diets do make a difference, and probably more than we realize as we are learning more about the pathophysiology.
Okay, let's take one more question, and then for those of you who want to stick around, I think some of our panelists are able to stay. Who's close to you over there? Okay.
Thank you. I just have a quick question for Dr. Kellogg. On the subjects that participated in your study, were they on other Alzheimer's medications like Namenda?
No, none of them were on any Alzheimer's medications.
Okay, thank you.
Were any of your patients women?
No, although we had a volunteer who really wanted to participate, who is a veteran, but I couldn't find a second female veteran. My mother was most disappointed, and she still wants to participate.
Well, I want to say thank you to everyone who came tonight to share our very first Think Health Science program, and there are more to come with Texas Public Radio. As we mentioned, I think some of the panelists can stay. We have a representative from the Alzheimer's Association here who's also available to talk to you if you have specific questions. I know they'll be happy to answer them. In addition to thanking the University of Texas Health Science Center for hosting us tonight, we also want to thank our very excellent panelists, Drs. Galvan, Solomon, and Kellogg. And we also, yes, please. And we wanted to let you know we're preserving the audio from tonight's presentation, so if there's something you want to go back and listen to, you can go to our website, tpr.org, and you'll find a little tab for Health Essay Archive, and you'll find the audio in a couple days from tonight's presentation. TPR hopes that we will see you again at some of our other events out in the community, and you can learn more about the engaging topics that we're going to be addressing by going to our website. Again, thanks to everyone, and we appreciate your taking part.